supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I first met our guest, Diana Chapman Walsh, 3 years ago. Well, I didn't actually meet her 3 years ago. She was a keynote speaker at the International Mind and Life Conference in Denver. So I attended that keynote speech because, well, frankly, I'd never heard of her before, and I attended it because, well, you know, I schlepped to Denver and I paid all this money, so might as well go see the speech. And I've got to tell you, I want to give you one quote about what she said in this speech. She said about the Genome Project. She said, mapping the Genome Project was just a small step because we're all a small part of something much larger. Now, this is from a leader, President Emerita of Wellesley College, and this speech was about leadership. She suggested that we must honor what we don't know, or else we dwell in the land of hubris and accomplish nothing. Well, frankly, that didn't sound like any leader I'd ever heard of. So when she was the keynote speaker again at the International Mind and Life Conference in Boston a few months ago, I was thrilled that she was there, and I couldn't wait to hear her. And when she was done, I just wanted more. I'd never heard a leader talk about leadership the way she did, with the passion, clarity, and compassion. So I am delighted to introduce you all to Dr. Diana Chapman Walsh. Diana, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dan, for that beautiful introduction. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Terrific. I want to give our listeners a chance to meet you, too. Our number here is 888-477-9499. Love to hear from you if you're a leader or aspire to be a leader. And I'd also love to hear from you if you have difficulties with the kind of leadership position your leaders take, your bosses take. Again, 888-477-9499. So, Diana, listen, we've got to start with a little Jewish geography here. What's your Philly roots?
Well, they're deep. I'm sorry to say they're not terribly Jewish, but I have a whole large group of friends who are. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. Both my parents were born and raised in Philadelphia. Three out of four of their parents were. My mother's roots went way, way back, traced all the way to William Penn, we believe, and they were Quakers. I have a sister who's just moved back to Philadelphia from being in St. Louis for most of her adult life, living in the center city, and just loving it. The new Philadelphia is fantastic. We still have a family place in the Pocono Mountains. And last year, I was back and got a taste of beautiful new Philadelphia when my husband was being awarded the 2014 Benjamin Franklin Medal in Chemistry. We went to a beautiful celebration that the Franklin Institute organized and had a wonderful time. So I love the city of brotherly love. It's in my blood.
So just one quick question about that before we move on. Why the hell aren't you living here?
Well, my mother always wanted the answer to that question. She had trouble understanding. She'd gone to Swarthmore College and thought I should have gone there.
Brace yourself. I could be channeling your mother. All right. So let's fast forward a couple of years.
Sure.
To 1993. You were chosen to be president of Wellesley College.
And
you claimed, I think it was in one of your speeches, that you didn't have a whole lot of leadership skills at the time, but that's not necessarily true. So when you got this big, big leadership job as president of a university, what had you known, understood about leadership before you got that job?
So, you know, it's a long, lifelong process, I think, we all go through, and we have tiny leadership opportunities as young people, and then if we're lucky, we have opportunities to test ourselves over and over in other ways. I had been, I won't trace the whole long story, we'll be here all day, but I left Philadelphia in 1962 and lived in Boston for the rest of my adult life until now, when we're living on two coasts. But I had worked in academia in various roles, but I had never been a provost or a dean or had that kind of administrative role that in the academy, in higher education, is considered an important testing ground for presidential leadership. So I had a steep learning curve. I knew it. The Presidential Search Committee at Wellesley knew it. They said to me later, someone said to me after it had been a successful run, not before, well, you know, we knew you had a lot to learn, but we thought it would be a lot of fun to learn with you.
Wow. Now that's an attitude going in.
Yes, right.
So, you know, you hear that, you got to think, well, this might be a cool gig for me.
Well, exactly. I think that's a very insightful comment, Dan, because the process, the selection process, was very intense. And I, by the end of it, I felt so confident that they really knew me, knew my strengths, knew my growing edges, had seen those, knew them. And so that gave me a kind of confidence to enter the role as a learner. And I was always a learner first, and that was an important part of what made it work for me and for everybody.
I would imagine, well, I know, that a lot of these interviews for becoming a leader, they do scrutinize you quite a bit. But then when you get the job, then you are the leader, period.
Yes.
So it's, yes. There's no we in there. It's all personal pronouns.
Well, no, that isn't the way I did it. I actually rarely used the big I because my leadership was about the we. Always. I was very conscious that I needed help, that no one person alone can know everything that needs to be known, can see all the different perspectives that need to be understood and factored into ethical and effective decisions in a large, complicated organization. So I was very deliberate, I would say, in my efforts to create a network around me of other people that was a we.
I wonder where that came from. I mean, I want to come back to the introduction where you said, unless we honor, and I don't know if this is an exact quote, but unless we honor what we don't know. And I think it takes some kind of courage to be able to look in the mirror and look at your peers and say, I can't do this alone. I need help. I can't do this without you. And mean it. You know, we hear that language, but really mean it. I think it takes a quality of courage to do that.
That's an interesting word to use because one of the influences on me that was powerful, and I think part of the secret of my success at this, was a connection with a man named Parker Palmer, an educator who's done a lot of writing, and his first book, and it was a wild bestseller, was called The Courage to Teach. So that word courage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's an organization that has been spun off to, as he likes to joke, put wheels on his ideas, and it's called the Center for Courage and Renewal. So yes, it's partly courage, but I think, you know, I would say with some humility, it was the only way I could do it. So it was partly just being honest about myself.
And that's what courage is. I'm a big fan of Brené Brown, the cognitive.
Oh yes.
Okay,
yes.
So you know her. So she talks about courage, and she talks about the Latin root of that word, C-U-R, which is heart.
And
she describes courage as the ability to speak from the heart, to speak your truth.
Yes.
And you know, these days, that really is courage, and that's what you're doing.
Well, thank you. I do admire her work. One of the things I discovered when I walked into the job, you captured it already in our conversation, at that moment of truth. It's all very well and good to have had good interviews and you think they understand you, but there is this moment when you realize this is it and I'm in charge and all of this is my responsibility ultimately. And I was very conscious at that point of, I don't use a word from your field, of projections, that people were looking at me and expecting things from me. I couldn't always even tell, but it was clear I was being sized up and I was on the spot. And I realized very soon in that force field, I'll call it, of projections, that I couldn't be pretending. If I were there trying desperately to be something that I thought some person or group of people were needing or demanding of me that I really wasn't the essence of who I was, then I would trip and fall. I just wouldn't be able to do the work. And so it was very important to me to be able to bring my uncertainties and my vulnerabilities out into the open, but in a particular and very thoughtful way, and I think that's what Brené Brown writes and talks about.
Wait a minute, young lady. what you? I guess I am channeling your mother. What you're describing is really counterintuitive, and it goes against the grain of what leaders are taught, and the traditional leadership is in the male model. You know, you put on your mask, you put on your shield, you never let your vulnerability show or else you'll get eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're describing is the opposite, showing your vulnerability.
Right, absolutely. And so the way it has to be done is in a way that is not disempowered. So you're bringing your full self, in all of its mystery and diversity forward, but you're not coming out of fear. You're not disempowered. So when you bring your vulnerabilities, you're not bringing them before you have had a chance yourself to come to terms with them, to think about them, to think about what it is you need to be bringing. It's not fear. I think the most important thing that I learned was you can't lead from fear. You can't even think when you're in your fear. Parker Palmer likes to say we all have our fears. Of course, that's what makes us human, but we don't have to be our fears.
Yeah, the fears don't have to be in the driver's seat. And I also find that in my office, when people get into power struggles and they're operating out of power, that they're doing it only because both people feel powerless.
Yes.
If you felt empowered, you wouldn't have to fight for power.
Yes.
Let me reintroduce you here, Diana, if you're just tuning in. Talking with Dr. Diana Chapman Walsh, she's president emeritus of Wellesley College, among many other things. She talks about leadership, and we're talking now about, believe it or not, vulnerability, power, and leadership. And you're not going to hear those three words in one sentence very often. Love to have you join our conversation. It's 1-888-477-9499. 1-888-477-9499. What does leadership mean to you as a leader, maybe at work, maybe at home, maybe interpersonally? Love to hear your experience with leadership. I want to come back a little bit. We're going back and forth like a good novelist here. Even before Wellesley College, one of your earlier jobs, I think, was when you were a Kellogg National Fellow. You traveled around the world and you studied workplace democracy and patterns of leadership. talking about a cool gig. But
yes.
I hear through the grapevine that you wrote a lot of poetry back then.
Yes.
Tell us about the poetry.
Well, that was interesting. I was an English major in college, and I love words and working with words. That's the world in which I'm most happy, I think, and comfortable. Poetry is important to me. When I was thinking about whether I should take on this job of being the president of Wellesley College, something for which I knew I wasn't completely prepared, I had to think about what I could bring to it. And there were two inputs in that discernment process that stayed with me and were important. And one was from my daughter, my beautiful, wonderful daughter, who had seen me all her life as a scholar doing research and writing articles, scholarly articles and books. And she said, "Mom, I'm not sure it will make you happy. I think of you as a scholar, and this is a very different kind of a role. You'll have to be out talking to people all the time. You won't have time for your writing." And I remember thinking, I don't think I said to her, "I will make my leadership my scholarship." So that was one part of it. It was about learning, and learning about myself, learning about the people around me, learning about how large systems work. But the second piece, so that wasn't the poetry, that wasn't your answer, but the second piece was, I remember going to speak to this friend, Parker Palmer, with whom I'd been writing this poetry during that period you mentioned with the Kellogg Fellowship. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, this was about a year into this new life of running a big college, and I said to him, "Parker, I have to confess, and I hate to do it, I'm not writing poetry anymore." And he didn't say anything right away. And a few hours later, he looked at me and he said, "Diana, I wonder if you could think of your presidency as your poetry." And so that was, you know, one of these comments from a friend that was just so freeing. But it was, in a way, that.
So,
writing poetry is about opening up your heart and your mind, and letting intuition flow in, and waiting to see, waiting in silence to see what may be there for you, and what you may know that you don't know you knew. That's one of the wonderful definitions of poetry. So I did a lot of that. A lot of my leadership was from within, from taking time to and stillness to think and with other people, and writing the words that moved the institution forward. I always wrote my own speeches, and they were a kind of poetry for me.
Well, your keynote speeches, both of them, were a kind of poetry also. But I you talk about leadership from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
What's that look like, feel like? Give us an example.
First of all, it's in partnership for me, almost always, with people with whom I have developed powerful relationships, and we're working together, and we have taken the time together to clarify what it is that brings us both to the work, what it is that inspires us in the work, what we hope from each other, expect from each other, want from each other.
So you're not talking about long range and short range planning here.
Well, we're doing that too. Yeah, I mean, so all this, but yes, so this work of building, sustaining, feeding, nurturing those powerful partnerships is what enables the long range planning, the fundraising, getting the buildings built, getting the budget trimmed, all of that hard work. So it's not that we're ignoring that hard work. It's really the foundation on which that work is done and done well.
Diana, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about trust in
yes.
leadership and trust in, well, of course, all relationships, and how that gets cultured and generated. You've been listening to Diana Chapman Walsh. As I said, she's president emerita of Wellesley College. And she also brings leadership skills to the Academy for Contemplative and Ethical Leadership, as well as the Kaiser Family Foundation. Our number is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines left. Please open. Please call earlier in the show, because, as you know, we always get backed up at the end. Leadership, what does it mean to you? What's your experience with leadership, personally or professionally? Again, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and boarding options is dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole. Taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering a campus tour on April 29th at 9 a.m. For more information, camphillspecialschool.org.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
I was 6 years old, riding around in my parents' car, and I was like, what is this stuff? And I just kept listening.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again each weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for NPR's Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family with Diana Chapman Walsh. We're talking about leadership. And Diana, you've said that nothing happens without trust. And I mean, that's the case with all relationships, right?
Yes.
So how do we build trust as a leader, as a therapist, as a friend, parent, or lover? How do we?
Yes, a great question. Well, first, we listen very well. We listen very well. And we're clear in our listening. We're listening for clues about what the other person needs from us and is expecting from us at that moment. So if it's someone, and now I'm talking about the interpersonal relations, someone who comes to us with a problem or a heartache, and we have to listen carefully to know whether that person is looking for a problem solver who can generate ideas and options, or whether that person at this moment just needs our heartfelt sympathy, empathy, and listening. And sometimes in interpersonal situations, the worst thing we can do when someone brings it is quickly jump to a list of, well, have you tried this, have you tried that, and because that just cuts off the opportunity to be heard. And being heard in this busy world that we all live in is rare and precious.
Well, I talk about Diana Collum. I used to write for the Philadelphia Inquirer years ago, and one of my most popular columns was when I said, I know four words that can change the world. It can end international conflict, cut down divorce, so on and so forth. And those four words are, tell me your story. What's it like to be you? What's it like to live inside your skin right at this moment? And then the other side of it is shut up and listen. You know, and imagine that to be your story. What's it feel like? And, you know, that whole encounter can take place in 3-5 minutes. You know, you don't have to date for 2 years.
Right. You're absolutely right. I love those two rules of thumb. They do say it all. And yes, we could almost call them technologies in this world where the thing that matters is technology. We can create social technologies, soft technologies that create the conditions in which two people, 20 people, 200 people can come together in different ways and do those two things you described. Tell me your story, shut up and listen. We know how to do that, and there are people who are doing it, and it's very exciting.
Well, wait a minute. You use the word social technology, and and I understand you're a poet at heart, but for me, you got to put it between two pieces of rye bread, or else I don't know what it is. So what do you mean by, what do you mean? My grandfather used to say that to me. So tell me what that is.
Well, so these social technologies are their principles, rules of thumb for how people come together in particular situations. So, for example, this man I mentioned, Parker Palmer, has something called circles of trust that he creates, and there are a set of touchstones that fit on a single page that everyone agrees to before the meeting starts. It's very different from Robert's Rules of Order, which is very hierarchical.
Yeah.
And it's that we bring our authentic selves. We listen to others. We don't interrupt. We don't try to fix and set people straight. We're there when all else fails. Turn to mystery. Now there's a poetic one in this. But a group of people can sit in a circle, read those together, reflect on them for a few minutes. What you know, put it between two pieces of rye bread. I don't know what you mean. And what does it mean for us? And how can we go forward in that? And then on a much larger scale, a colleague and friend named Otto Scharmer is doing it in groups of hundreds of people.
What does that look like?
Well, he has something. He wrote a book that is it is enormous. It could be a doorstop and wouldn't fit between your two pieces of rye bread. It's called Theory U. But the idea is pretty simple. He's worked out all the details. The idea is you create agreements and a context in which people can first open their minds and then open their hearts and then open their will, that is, decide to do something together, and there's a point, as he describes it, at which they're all together and they start to realize that we are in this together, and among us we have the resources we need.
Okay, so I want to take that, we are all in this together, to something you and so many of us feel passionate about. And that's the environment. You've been talking about that extensively.
Yes,
and,
I have.
And there is no sense, Diana, of we're all in this together. There is no sense of that. I mean, there's this low-grade anxiety in those who care. You know, and we recycle our plastics, but...
Right.
You know, and
right.
then there's the massive denial, and certainly there's no political will, and hasn't been for decades.
Yes,
in this country.
Yes.
So
yes.
How? All right, Dr. Leader here.
Yes.
How do we get a sense that we're all in this together?
Right. Absolutely. That's you're right. I care deeply about that, and I've been focusing on it a lot. I think we have to recognize it as our problem, every one of us. And I think it's helpful not to be too focused on trying to locate the blame somewhere. Blaming and shaming is totally disempowering and demoralizing for everybody. The world changed. We developed these amazing technologies that have dramatically improved our lives. That's wonderful, but they had this dark underside. We're now using, we have one Earth, but we're using the equivalent of 1.5 planets. We cannot continue doing that. There are very fundamental changes we have to make. So how do we do it?
I want to stop you right there. As somebody you are developing a relationship with, who is going to get me theoretical and maybe even in fact to be in this with you. And I was aware of the language you just used about consuming 1.5 times our planet.
Yes.
I felt a tightness, literally, Diana, a tightness in my chest, and I felt uncomfortable, and I didn't, just in a flash, I wanted to shut down.
Yes.
So, and I wonder if that's what happens nationally. I mean, all we
have done
is just scare the hell out of everybody.
Right, right. No. It's true, and I know the tightening. I was sitting with my beloved 6-year-old grandson the other day in California visiting, and he said, "Nana, when will this drought be over?" And I knew, because I've been studying this issue, that the answer is, I'm afraid, not in your lifetime, and it's going to be worse. I couldn't say that to him, but the knot in my stomach was just enormous. I think the only way we'll do it is to find the power in our ability to come together. And the vantage point from which I'm watching this is the vantage point I've known all my life, and that's college and university campuses. Things are happening there now that do give me encouragement, and not only the amazing research. I mean, I'm on the board and the executive committee at MIT, which we could argue was one of the places that created the Industrial Revolution and all these wonderful technologies that now have to slow down in certain ways. And on these campuses, the students, groups of students, are starting to pay attention to this, and they're paying attention to it in a respectful way. They're trying to make connections. They're trying to think about how to educate people. This academic year began with the People's Climate March in New York City, and around the world. There were marches all over the world. It was an enormous coming together of people.
Yeah. And where's the wheels on that trolley?
Where's the wheels on the trolley? I think the wheels is not to look away. And these leaders who created that event and who've made the commitment are not looking away. And so it's creating a we. There's a wonderful poem that talks about creating a we. And each day, the we means one more. And we need to keep talking to our friends, to our colleagues, to help them understand that this is our children's future. When you look at the college campuses, when you talk to these young people, which I do, you realize that they see the leaders, all the leaders, the grown-ups, paralyzed before a window that they see closing rapidly on their chance to have a future. And so they're standing, in some ways, between the impossible, which is, can we mobilize action here in time? That's the impossible, and the unthinkable, which is a planetary meltdown on the magnitude that some scientists are predicting. And what a way to start your adult life, standing in that place. So we need to partner with them.
Well, can I tell you my thought about that now that you are my official leadership mentor? I might be a naive therapist here, but I see this as an act of love for my unborn progeny.
Exactly.
To love my children who I've never met and I will not meet. And what am I going to do for them? And an act of love for Mother Earth.
Yes.
And I feel the same way, Diana, towards my body. I mean, as you know, I'm a quadriplegic, and my body is, how can I say this medically, pretty screwed up. And my reaction to my body is just an act of love and deep, deep gratitude for this body who has carried me through so much adversity. And boy, you know, that kind of attitude, if we could feel it for all of our bodies and expand that to the ground we walk on, to the air we breathe, this kind of gratitude and love, then we'd be acting out of love and not fear.
Yes, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Now you're my guru on what we can do about the climate. But yes, absolutely. You know, there was a book that was written called Anything We Love Can Be Saved.
Mm.
Anything we love can be saved. And I think that's true. And I think we do love this planet Earth. I think we get up in the morning and we go outside and we look at the sky and it's blue or it's cloudy, and we see a tree starting to blossom at this time of the year and along the Schuylkill or wherever. It evokes something visceral in our hearts. The beauty of nature, the beauty of this planet, the beauty of this life we have together.
I got to tell you one quick story. My producer's encouraging me to take a break, but let me just tell you this one quick vignette. It was shortly after my sister died, and you know, mm-hmm. she felt so very present to me. And you know, mm-hmm. I wondered. I'm not a big believer in the Charlton Heston God or the heaven mm-hmm. with angels, but I was thinking about her a lot. I had to give mm-hmm. a talk up in the suburbs, and I was there early, and I drove up West River Bank and on the Schuylkill, and it had to be in May, so it was gorgeous there. And I just pulled over, and I'm looking at the boats on there, the sculls, and practicing up for big races. It was and the people running, and I thought, where is my sister now? And, if there is a heaven. And I thought, well, she'd be watching this. She'd be seeing all this beauty. And then after I was, in there for a little while, I realized, holy crap, I'm watching it now and I don't have to be dead. So I had that going for me. Let's take a short break. We're going to talk more about love, compassion, and taking individual leadership in the world we live in. We're speaking with Diana Chapman Walsh, President Emerita of Wellesley College, and one of the leaders and prime movers of the Academy for Contemplative and Ethical Leadership, as well as the Kaiser Family Foundation. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation offers services that make coping with death and taxes a little easier. The Foundation manages the legacies of individuals from Ben Franklin to Luther Vandross. It can assist you, too, with estate planning so that you may have an enduring philanthropic impact. You also may receive ongoing tax deductions for sustaining southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
When composer Philip Glass first started performing his music, it was so different and new that sometimes audiences would get angry. So angry, they'd throw things.
If they threw apples and oranges, that wasn't so great. But if they threw an egg, it isn't so bad, because the eggs would just break. No, that could be...
He's our guest on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with Diana Chapman Walsh about leadership, love, trust, compassion, and the earth we live in. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Anne calling us from Center City. Hi, Anne.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dan.
Hi.
Wonderful, wonderful segment. Perfect for where I am in my life. My question to Diana, I may call her Diana. Diana, sure. I'm 66 years old. I've been a leader or in leadership positions all my life, in my job, in my community, politically, in healthcare. I've been in this inquiry about leadership, so I've decided that I wanted to go to graduate school and go to Penn and take an academic approach with others to just satisfy my inquiry, but also I feel like I have so much more to give and so much more to, so many ways to serve and so much more to learn. And at times that's very, I was going to say concerning, but the truth is it's frightening. And I just wanted your opinion on that.
Did you say frightening, Anne?
I certainly did, like F-E-A-R.
What are you scared of?
I have no idea.
Does this?
I have no idea. Maybe it's just stepping out. Maybe it's the change. Maybe it's my age. I have no idea.
Well,
but it comes up.
Before I turn you over to the real expert, I'm going to steal a line from a poet who wrote this. He didn't even sign his name to it, but one of the lines was, "Fear is the friction in transitions." Hmm. Poetry indeed. Diana, I'm curious about your thoughts for Anne.
Yes, and thank you for calling, and just tremendous admiration and encouragement for you. I think we are all lifelong learners. I think that's the gift we've been given, is to continue learning and to continue growing. And so I would encourage you to see the fear in the way Dr. Dan has just mm-hmm. described it as a kind of energy. It's a kind of awareness that this is a big moment, excitement and kind of the thrill of the possibility of stepping out into something new. There are many ways, too, in which you can pursue these interests. These days, there are all of these courses that are online, many of them for free now through academic institutions. You could try one of those for a little bit and get your feet warm and see how that goes, or as you said, go to Penn in graduate school. But I would just strongly encourage you to do it, because whatever you gain from it, and you will surely gain from it, will help you, as you say, to give back to others. Others will see you in this learning mode. That in itself is an inspiration to understand for young people who are in school, in the school-aged years, in college, in the college-aged years, to see older people coming back, non-traditional age people, committing to their learning is a really important lesson for all of us.
We did a show once on curiosity and cultivating curiosity. Mm. And you know, our own Terry Gross here in Philadelphia, yes, who hosts Fresh Air, she said that's what her parents did when she was a kid. She would ask all these questions. And they would, none of them was silly, and they would encourage her to follow up on this curiosity. It's in there. So you know, I just want to second what Diana said. Be curious. Be curious about what's in the future. Be curious about what's in your mind and heart. And even be curious about your anxiety. Approach it as something curious. What is that?
Like
Diana said, I really wish you the best, and please, more than anything, have fun.
Mm.
At that age, 66, at our age, you know, we paid our dues. It's okay to have fun now at this stage of life.
Nothing more to prove, right?
Exactly. Somebody said that was what freedom was, wasn't it? Yes. Or nothing left to lose.
Oh, wasn't that Janis Joplin or somebody?
Yeah.
Now I'm dating myself.
Go on.
Dan, I just wanted to connect with you on your sister, because I, too, had a sister who died not so long ago. And she had, one of her last speeches was to the Phi Beta Kappa Society at the university where she taught, and it was about curiosity. She was always curious. Part of what brings me so deeply into this question about the climate is that it was something that she saw coming before anyone else did, and I feel her, I feel her support as I move into this world.
And honoring her legacy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joyce on the line. Hi, Joyce.
Yes, hi. Thank you for this opportunity. I have a grandson. He's seven, and he'll be turning eight soon. And it's always a puzzlement how to you try to instill leadership without them becoming overbearing to their friends or anyone in their groups or in class. And I find it a puzzlement. How do I instill this without making him to be, you know, overbearing?
Well, before you know, I get all clinical here and ask the only question we know how to ask, and that is, why? Why do you want to instill it in him? But I want to hear, Diane, I want to hear your take first on how do we help children become leaders?
So, Joyce, thank you for that question, and I feel such a connection to you. I have a grandson who's today is his 6 and a half birthday. We have to celebrate half birthdays in this. And he, too. I watch him, and he thinks he has every known superpower in the world of the superheroes. And I worry about whether your overbearing comment, certainly I think about that. I think that the learning these young people at that age need is the most important capacity, I believe, of effective, trustworthy leadership, and that is to learn how to put themselves in somebody else's shoes, to learn how to listen to other people, to learn how to hold their own ego in check sometimes, and to wonder with curiosity what might it be that caused someone else to do something. I've just been doing something, having that conversation with my grandson. His name is Sean, who one of the neighbor kids came over, a little four-year-old and her older sister, and Sean went off with the older sister, and they excluded the little sister. Sean doesn't have siblings, so he hasn't had to work this through, and the little one tore up something he cared about that he had done, and he was very angry, and we have been talking about, so why might she have done it? What might have been in her mind? That's been a useful learning for him, this idea of empathy. So I think they can be learning empathy. That's what their teachers and others are trying to teach them, and some humility, even as they're also understanding that they can be effective in the world.
With all due respect, I'm not going to disagree. Yeah. This concept of learning. I would use the word relearning because children are born with this. I did a study many years ago where toddlers, kids not even at that stage, you know, when somebody accidentally dropped something on the floor, they would pick it up and crawl over to that person and hand it to them. So, you know, it's in our hard wiring. It's in our evolutionary genes.
Absolutely.
You know, we couldn't have survived without it. So it's in there. And in a way, Diane, it's kind of sad that as young as age 6, 7, it's got to be relearned.
Well, and that's the messages that our culture is sending. The competition, everything's arranged in a hierarchy. It's all about consumerism and all of that. And so we're trying to counter that, and it's so powerful, it's difficult to counter.
We've got several callers, and we're not going to be able to get them on, but I just want to read to you something that one of the callers said. He said he wants us to step out of the theoretical. Mm-hmm. Can these ideas be applied to the real world to stop bullying bosses?
Mm-hmm. Well, they can, yes. I mean, I'm here to say that these ideas were the foundational thinking through which for 14 years I and my team led Wellesley College. So they and successfully, I would add, without making a fine point of that. So they can be applied. I think the questioner is asking about something specific, which is if you're in a situation where you have someone above you in a leadership hierarchy who is extremely difficult, How do you handle that? That's challenging, for sure. I think one thing is to look for others in the organization with whom you may be able to make common cause and to think about ways in which you might be able to hold a mirror up to this person whose leadership is destructive, dysfunctional. Together, it's very hard alone to confront that. Dr. Dan, it sounds like you're taking a breath to help me out.
Well, yeah, I am. So there's one other thing you could do here, and that's what we've been talking about here, compassion.
Absolutely.
First, compassion for yourself. In that yes. moment, in that moment, you're suffering. So I want you to, you know, as they say, hold your life in that moment as you would a suffering child. Just hold it with love and gentleness and do for you, for that body, for that heart, act out of kindness and act out of support. And the other thing is, you know, one day in the not too distant future, you might be able to see your boss that way. As, you know, if he's a bully, he's a man who's suffering. You know, bullies are not happy by and large. Bullies have a great deal of anxiety and insecurity, and if they didn't, they wouldn't need to be bullies. But first, compassion for this person who you whose skin you live inside of, who suffers. You know, and then you can find kindred spirits, not a group you can complain about the boss.
No,
with, but,
no.
You know, truly kindred spirits.
Right.
Diana, I got to tell you the worst thing about my day so far.
Yes.
We're out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That is bad.
Heartbreaking.
This has been fun.
Yeah, come to Philly. We'll do it here in the studio.
Good.
I'd love to meet you in person and thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Dan. I've enjoyed this very much.
You too. Our guest today has been Diana Chapman Walsh, President Emerita of Wellesley College, where you can follow us on Twitter with Voices in the Fam, email us at voices@whyy.org, or follow me on my webpage. It's drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family, and I thank her for that. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.